The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, international qualifiers ahoy. We unleash a top team of urologists as we tackle England, Wales, Rob Earnshaw like Gerard Depardieu in trouble for not putting it away. Scotland, a little bit. Ireland and proper nations like Estonia and Armenia. There's Philippe Auclair on French things and why he ran from his nominative deterministic pastry destiny at the cake shop. There's Sid in Spain. Perhaps posts, tweets and our preview of the weekend's Premier League action in a show even Rob Earnshaw would find unmissable. That's today's Football Weekly Extra. Nobody touch nothing. Hi, everybody. On board today, it's Barry Glendenning.
Hello, James.
Hi, Barry. Nice to see you back. Yeah, they're all right, actually.
Good, good, good.
Also, Philippe Auclair. Bienvenue.
Am I supposed to say bonjour?
You can do.
Bonjour, Jimbo.
Yeah, ça va and that.
Ça va?
Yeah.
Ça va and that.
Yeah. You've been having...
Egg and chips later on as well.
Yeah. And you can be telling us all about all sorts of things, Philippe. French things, your Toots and the Maytals ticket misery, perhaps.
I shouldn't
have gone there, should I?
No, it's not resolved yet.
All right, a little bit of a more heartwarming bit of news from Jacob Steinberg, though. Captain Jacob Steinberg, on board today, fresh from his triumph at the Opta Sports Quiz.
Opta Football Quiz.
Oh, the Opta Football Sports Quiz.
Only football.
Only football, but yeah. Basically the non plus ultra of football quizzes. There is no, I mean, this is the quiz, basically. Yeah. Who goes in for it, Jacob?
What, who was competing?
Yeah, who was competing?
Sky, ESPN, 442, ITV. The Times and the Telegraph didn't show up.
They didn't, did they?
They were meant to have a team and they didn't turn up.
They were the lucky ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they heard.
Because what happened?
The Guardian won.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Do you want to give us a couple of sample questions? And what kind of thing are we talking about?
Okay. Who was the last England player to score at the Old Wembley?
There you go. Listeners, yeah. Who was he? Or she. Could have been a she. That's kind of a trick question. True. They throw out there, isn't it?
And who is the first player to miss a penalty in an FA Cup final? I don't think anybody will get this.
Okay, well, so two terrific questions. Do you want to throw one more out?
Who's the only player to score more than 100 Premier League goals at a single stadium?
I have to say, when I was printing those questions off, I saw that. I think it's Matt Letizia.
What?
No.
Shearer?
No.
Oh,
it's Thierry Henry at Highbury.
Oh, Thierry Henry.
That's ruined the quiz.
Wow.
For the listeners.
Oh, yeah. Oh, anyway, they had, I think, ample time to try and answer it all, apparently. Probably. Anyway, listen, let's get on then with today's show. England-Wales. Capello says he saw in the warm-up that it wouldn't be any good. Was this when he looked at the programme and said it was England-Wales? What? What is that about? Philippe?
I was at Wembley. I didn't see anything in the warm-up that I found particularly strange. The team sheet, I think, was greeted with some surprise. For example, people were asking the question, is Scott Parker on the bench because he's one yellow away from suspension and the game against Montenegro is more important, blah, 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 blah. But it was pretty dire. I mean, it's been pretty dire of late. I think there had been four or five games without a win before that.
Yes.
And all of them had been pretty dire, but this was really absolutely appalling. The last 25 minutes, probably the worst I've seen from an England side at Wembley for a very, very long time.
How long, Philippe?
I've been watching football here for a while.
Right, so you're including the McLaren era, you're including all sorts of other dark days.
Yeah, I mean, mutatis mutandi, of course, because of the circumstances, the opponent, you know, Wales were short of two of their best players. Yeah. The pitch was absolutely blameless this time. The selection didn't look right. The shape of the team didn't look right. And one thing that really surprised me is that the speed of the passing was appalling because there was no speed, no rhythm. The players were receiving the ball in static positions and couldn't basically do a thing. And the quality of the play from the back was also very poor distribution. Chris Smalling was regularly sending the ball 20, 30 yards further than he would in a Manchester United shirt, which is a little bit worrying. Frank Lampard is past it. I mean, I think we all know that. It was not very inspiring, and Wales definitely should have come back with... I use the word definitely, which is football speak. Mm. Should definitely have come back from Wembley with a point.
All right,
but that miss was remarkable.
It certainly was. Barry?
I've heard before, I'm not sure if it's in here we've discussed it in the pod or not, but that Manchester United used to get annoyed when Chris Smalling went off on England under-21 duty because at Old Trafford he's encouraged to play it out the back and short passes, whereas he'd come back from an England under 21 match and be hoofing it down the pitch. So I don't know if this is another sort of symptom of that.
The mind enfeebling that goes on in.
I mean, as I say, I didn't see the game. But England's players, right, they're not world beaters, we know that, and they've consistently proved it, but I don't think they're as bad as their collective efforts suggest. And is it a case that the crowd are getting on their back? Or?
No, not really. The crowd are actually very supportive. If the silent, actually, almost during the second half, there was no booing. Lampard got a very good reception, and also when he left the pitch and so forth. And no, the crowd was absolutely no problem on that side. It's just that it's the England syndrome. You put an England shirt on these players, and suddenly they seem to lose their technique, they seem to lose their imagination, with the exception of Stuart Downing, who was truly excellent.
In fact, the only problem with boos at the stadium was probably Andy Carroll. The interesting motivational technique there from Fabio Capello. 6 points clear for England now. Very comfortable there on one hand. But on the other hand, Montenegro in second place have two games still to go, one of which is a game in hand. The other is their home clash with England, which can be interesting at this point, eh, Jacob?
Yeah, but I don't think that England will lose that game.
No?
No.
Okay.
No.
Don't forget they've got to play Switzerland away as well. And Switzerland is finding some form at last.
Montenegro have.
Yeah. England are more or less there for their.
All right, Jacob says they're more or less there.
For their quarterfinal.
They're about in the same position as France were in 1993 before we had to get 1 point against Bulgaria and Israel at home. And you know what happened?
It would take a hideous collapse for England to not qualify now.
Right.
And if anyone can do it.
All right. Elsewhere, Barry, Ireland. Another 0-0 draw, but this time it's all right.
It was a heroic 0-0 draw. Ireland had Russia on the ropes throughout. I don't know how they failed to win the game. Richard Dunn finished the game, I think, with staples in his face and a blood-soaked shirt with a number 5 drawn on it in marker by one of the backroom staff.
Seriously?
Yes.
They had to draw the number on.
What would Roy Keane have said about that?
He went in on a tackle on one of the Russians, and they both went over the off the plastic pitch onto the running track, and Don landed face first. I think he cut his face on his cheek and his lip on maybe a piece of iron grating or something used for drainage. He looked a mess, and he'd been absolutely immense throughout for Ireland. And I mean, I was being facetious there. Ireland were so unbelievably
26
lucky.
26 shots to 4. Only one of Ireland's 4 shots was from inside 30 yards of goal.
I can't actually remember Ireland's 4 shots.
It may have been
shots.
In the warm-up.
Do you count goal kicks as shots? Yeah.
Because at half-time, I think Russia had 14 shots on target to Ireland's 1, and I was struggling to remember Ireland's 1.
Right. Shea Given presumably had a blind in there, didn't he?
Shea Given played brilliantly. He pulled off some stunning saves. Richard Dunn was also superb. But anyway, sorry, to go back to the story about Dunn, he needed to get treatment, and they basically, I think they literally stapled this wound on his face together, but there was blood on his shirt, so the ref made him remove it. So he put on a new shirt, a clean one with no number on it, and went back out onto the field, and the ref insisted he go off again. And he looked a bit groggy, and there was some suggestion that the ref thought, look, you're too injured to carry on, you have to go off. But it actually transpired the ref was such a job's worth, he wouldn't let him play unless he had a number on his shirt. So
it's kind of the rules.
Well, anyway, Alan Kelly from the Ireland backroom staff had to get out a black magic marker and write a number 5 on the front and back of Dunn's shirt before he could go
out. How long did
continue.
That take?
It took about 3 minutes.
So he put his heart into it.
But while this was happening, Ireland were incredibly under the cosh, like, with their best player off the field. But we held on, and then amazingly, Armenia did us a favour later that night by beating Slovakia 4-0 at home.
That's amazing, isn't it?
So Ireland could win the group now. They've 2 games left against Andorra and Armenia, and Russia have to play Slovakia. So if Slovakia could beat Russia, Ireland could conceivably win the group.
And Armenia could go through in second, couldn't they?
Yes, well, there's a very good chance Ireland will undo. Like, they have used all their luck and a lot more besides, so it would not be entirely surprising if they went and messed up against Andorra or Armenia. No.
All right.
I did hear, actually, Robbie Keane, obviously Aidan McGeady plays in Moscow now, so he didn't have too far to go home. after the game. Robbie Keane went back to LA via Shanghai from Moscow. So
I saw
he could still be in midair somewhere.
I saw Robbie Keane when he had the ball at one point for where he wants one of his players to go. Is that just so?
He's always
annoying.
Been very good at pointing.
Yeah, and then he didn't even pass to him, and he just crossed it out of play.
Is that like a no-look pass, but kind of even more so?
The Irish version of a Ronaldinho.
Lovely. Okay, now Scotland. Ooh, a win against Lithuania.
Yep. I didn't see this
I saw this one, and I was very impressed with Scots, actually. Yep. They weren't up against much, but they played very well. And Barry Bannon, the Aston Villa midfielder come winger, was absolutely fantastic. I think it was his first start in a competitive international. He was really, really good.
Oh, that's nice. Spain have won this group. Sorry.
The Scots only won 1-0, and they were sort of on the ropes towards the end. They need to learn to sort of close games out, but there's a lot of room for encouragement.
Well done, Scotland, for a 1-0 win.
I'm patronising them now, patting them on the head.
Spain have won this group. Scots are 2 points behind the Czech Republic in the race for second place. They need to pick up 3 more points in those games than the Czechs manage at home to Spain and then in Lithuania. So, doesn't look good. Northern Ireland, just to finish off part one, another shock result there. Estonia with a 4-1 win in Tallinn, wasn't it? And hideous defensive errors. What's the solution, Barry?
Stop making hideous defensive errors. Okay.
Or bring back Laurie Sanchez.
Well, that's the solution Laurie Sanchez has suggested.
Coincidentally.
Yeah. He launched a savage attack on Nigel Worthington and then sort of said, I want another crack at the job. To be fair, he was successful as Northern Ireland manager up to a point.
The point being when he walked out?
Yeah, to take over at Fulham, which he was less successful at. Mm. I'm pretty sure his manager, Barnett, or he was up until very recently, so I'm not sure how they'll feel about him canvassing for the Northern Ireland
job. Maybe he could do both. It's been known to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Myself and James Dart are going to watch Barnett on Plymouth next Tuesday.
Are you?
On our annual trip to Underhill.
That's lovely. Italy have won that group, having conceded just one goal in the course of the qualifying. Amazing stuff for them. They had a 1-0 win against Slovenia in Florence. Gianpaolo Pazzini with the goal. Balotelli.
Sorry, 90th, why did they play in Florence?
90th minute.
They will go all around the place.
After their glorious 1-0.
I thought there was 5 minutes to go, I think, wasn't
there?
It was towards the death. Anyway, they went with 3 up front. They brought on Balotelli, and that really swung the game in their favour, and Pazzini stuck it away. Balotelli back in favour now after his iPad controversy. The Faroe Islands game, and Prandelli's even talking about putting him in the starting lineup for the final game.
There's one question, though.
Yes?
Why isn't the greatest striker in Italian football in that team, Mr. Di Natale?
It's a good question, actually.
It's incomprehensible. I know he's 33, but he has been the best Italian striker.
He's been fantastic, hasn't
he? For Empoli, for Udinese. Mm. He's just absolutely magnificent. And for some reason, he can't get his way back in that team.
One suspects it's got something to do with Prandelli's turning over a new leaf after the debacle in what's the French for debacle?
I don't know. Ask George Bush.
Okay. Anyway, very nice. Very nice. In South Africa. Yeah. Anyway, Serie A, it's back on this Friday. Milan playing Lazio. The strike is off, I think. It's a good way to start, isn't it, Milan-Lazio? Anyway, we'll be reacting to that on Monday. Big Serie A special. I feel it brewing. Hey, that's it for part one. After this, Sid. Part two, everybody, and it's Sid Lowe on the line from Spain. Hi, Sid.
Hello, James. How are you?
Very well, very well. Glad to hear you're better, Dr. Sid. And let's see. Now, Spain. A 6-0 win over Liechtenstein. And poor old Fernando Torres, eh?
Yeah, Torres, who was in the Spain squad, but then obviously, as I'm sure everybody knows, the squads are, 22, 23 players long. And then for every game, you can't have all of those players on the bench. Torres was one of those players that was left out of the match squad, not even in the team. Álvaro Negredo played and scored twice, and it does provoke the question as to what now for Fernando Torres. Now, let's not get too excited, because Negredo has only scored 2 goals against Liechtenstein, but he's been very, very good over the last 6 months for Sevilla. I think there are 2 or 3 players that right now probably deserve a Spain place ahead of Torres. Fernando Llorente is one. Negredo is another. Of course, David Villa is in there as well. The way that Spain plays means that they don't necessarily need that Torres-style striker in the Emil Heskey role, as I believe I described it during the World Cup, to much guffawing from pretty much everybody. I think Torres will stay in the squad in the short term because Vicente del Bosque is very loyal to him, because Torres is very, very well-liked within the entire federation, within the entire setup, and he's believed by a lot of players in the team, particularly David Villa, to be more useful than his goal-scoring record suggests. But certainly Torres, I think, is under real pressure now and needs some good performances before the European Championships, because there are players who are pushing. And I've only mentioned the ones in the squad. You've also got Roberto Soldado playing really well for Valencia. So, yeah, he's under a lot of pressure now.
All right. It's probably his shoes. I think that could be the problem for him.
I think it is. It's probably those power pods that are doing it.
Listen, also of late, Spain played Chile. It turns out they won. How about that?
You know what the best thing about it was, James?
Yes.
Well, you probably say yes. You say yes because you probably do.
Is it the brawl?
Exactly. It was the punch-up. And that sounds flippant, and it is flippant, but there's a reason why I say this. The fight has, a slightly weird sort of way, been taken as the best thing that could have possibly happened to the national team, because players from Madrid and Barcelona waded in on each other's side. Now, this comes in the context of this falling out between Madrid and Barcelona over the Clásicos, a sense that there's a really difficult atmosphere in the squad amongst some players, which actually there is. I mean, that's not false at all. That's true. And the sense of players wading in to help each other out, Arbeloa was involved, Busquets, Iniesta, Cesc Fabregas was there, Sergio Ramos, has been taken here as almost a kind of sign of peace. It's quite bizarre, isn't it, that peace comes with a punch-up. But that's how it's been dealt with. Now, I think there's a couple of other readings of it. I think one of them is, oh, look, it's the usual characters, and I think it tells you something about their attitudes as much as necessarily who they're fighting against. And also maybe what it might do in terms of smoothing things over to some extent within the Spanish squad is it might help to relativize those fights in the Clásicos and say, well, look, in the heat of a moment in the game, you fight with people and you fight for people that you don't like, and you fight against people that sometimes maybe you do.
I think there's always circumstances as well when enmities are buried, but only temporarily. The social historian Dre, for example, points out that back in the LA riots, Bloods and Crips were on the same squad. But after, you know, the riots died out, they were very much, you know, back to
that's
their old...
That's a really important point, James, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Sid, a magnificent, particularly folkloristic roundup there of the situation in Spain. Many, many thanks for that, and look forward to speaking to you on Monday.
Brilliant. Speak to you then. Bye.
Cheers,
bye.
Sid. Okay, then. Let's see. Ooh, France, Philippe.
What about them?
Well, 0-0 in Romania, and here come Bosnia-Herzegovina, just 1 point behind...
Yeah,
aye,
as you say, and you would say aye, if you had seen both games, because the game against Albania, which we won 2-1, was excruciating to watch, and the one in Romania was even worse. I must say that the pitch was in such poor state that it could explain that, you know, France wasn't playing any kind of fluent football, but neither was Romania, but... People, you know, all the hopes and expectations that people had when Laurent Blanc seemed to have found some new order, particularly if you think back, victory at Wembley against England, when France really looked rather good with the triangle and Villa, Nasri and Gourcuff, and people thought, we've got a team there which is starting to play like French teams should play. This has gone out completely. It's awful to watch. On this occasion, actually, Laurent Blanc had lost patience with Semih Nasri, decided to put him on the bench, which Nasri didn't take very kindly to.
Is that where he broke his hand?
He broke his hand once he came on the pitch. He came on the pitch at the 74th or 75th minute. And at one point, actually, people were reporting a broken metatarsal. You know, it's metacarpal. So he should be playing this weekend for Manchester City.
Is there any suggestion that the decline in French form has been coincident with the return of all those rebels from South Africa?
I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the most problematic areas is Franck Ribéry. Our friend Ribéry, who hasn't been exactly pulling trees, as they say in football speak again, that's 10 points for football clichés today. Definitely.
Producer Ben says he's probably been pulling something else. That producer Ben.
This has been thrown out of court, producer Ben. Has been thrown out of court. Anyway, he insists on playing on the left-hand side. He hasn't been exactly great with Bayern Munich. and this has the effect of pushing Malouda to the right, where he's hopeless. Malouda is very, very, is not pleased at all with the situation, as let it be known. Patrice Evra certainly doesn't look like the same player that he is for Manchester United, I mean, which means that he's as bad a defender, but going forward he offers nothing with the French. He's also been extremely forthright in his views after the game, refusing actually to talk to supporters and just throwing a jeering Vive la France to the reporters who were there. I mean, it's really great atmosphere. Samir Nasri is in danger of losing his place to Marvin Martin as the so-called playmaker in Blanc's system. And, okay, the results are not too bad. I mean, you look at the games ahead, it shouldn't be too bad. We've played all our games away. We've still to play Albania at home on the 7th of October and Bosnia-Herzegovina on the 11th. So two games at home.
It's a big game, that one.
It's a big game, but honestly, it shouldn't be too bad for us.
Okay. I've got a whole list of questions from listeners here. Yeah. Any colour you like, says Joe Cole. What do you make of that one, eh?
I'm thrilled.
Is he going to play?
Of course he's going to play.
I don't know.
Why shouldn't he play?
What do you think about him commuting from London to Lille?
No, he's moving his whole family to Lille.
Oh, he's now
he's moving his family to the area, which I think is a very good move. On the other hand, if he wanted to commute from London to Lille, that's dead easy. Eurostar to Lille Europe, very simple. Mm. I know a few Premiership footballers who live much further away from their club than Joe Cole would in that case.
Mm. Is Lille
if I seem to remember, Djibril Cissé used to live on a different continent when he was at Sunderland, or almost.
Winston Bohardi, I think. Him at this point.
Extraordinary. Yeah. But no, I mean, his people are really excited about him coming to Lille. He's made all the right noises as well when he's arrived.
Right.
Which means that he hasn't pretended it was the dream come true, but he's shown that he had watched Lille, that he knew a few of the players. And I must say, the idea of seeing Eden Hazard link with Joe Cole, that's fairly exciting. And as well, Rudy Garcia, the Lille coach, has... Why are you frowning like this?
Joe Cole's kind of lost his pace. He's had too many injuries.
So. He can play... The French league is not played at the same kind of tempo at all.
Oh, really? Because that was one of the questions.
Come on.
Well, what's the feeling regarding the future of Ligue 1? Is the arrival of people like Joe Cole and perhaps more pertinently Javier Pastore
and others, and the capacity of keeping players. I mean, for example, Kevin Gamero, who I think is going to be a super player, he's already a super player, would probably have left for another league already. If it hadn't been for the financial muscle of Paris Saint-Germain, which trickles down a little bit to the clubs around them, like Lorient, for example, have been the beneficiaries of that. Have been able to get Gilles Sunu and Joel Campbell from Arsenal, thanks to that money. That's changing things quite a lot, and it's also changing people's attitudes towards financial fair play, for example, because as you know, in France. The one thing people will always tell you is that, yeah, if there was a DNCG in England, in Spain, in Italy, France would be in its rightful place, blah, blah, blah. You don't hear these people speak as loudly now.
So the big difference is the money coming in at Paris Saint-Germain. It's not a bigger TV deal or anything like that.
No, a smaller TV deal. We're waiting to hear. I mean, we have to see. The league has launched their own TV channel. Yes, they have. And we're waiting to see how much of a success this is going to be. Financially, it's not disastrous, even though the financial results of the clubs are worrying, of most of the clubs are worrying. Think of Lyon, for example, is very worrying. They'll have to have a good campaign in the Champions League, let's put it that way. But it has PSG is doing well. Lille, I was really worried about them because of the number of players they lost. You know, Yohan Cabaye, Adil Rami, Javinho, of course, but they've managed to hang on to Hazard and to Moussa Sow, and now with Joe Cole, you're thinking, well, actually, there's still a very good nucleus there. So things are looking up a little bit. We've got players who are staying, and we've got players who are coming back, even if it's not for very long, like Steve Malbronk.
That's another question. Steve Malbronk. Can Philippe Auclair cast some light on the Steve Malbronk story, why he's retired? Because basically,
he hasn't retired.
He hasn't retired. The story was that he'd retired because his son.
No, this, forget, he doesn't have a son.
Right, but that was
okay,
the story.
There have been some absolutely awful. Well, this is the age of Twitter nonsense.
Oh, okay.
As some people feel that they have the right to speak about other people's private lives and not knowing any details about it. Steve Malbronk is a very withdrawn sort of character, somebody who is not necessarily in love with football. He wanted to be a tennis player when he was a teenager and maybe could have become a professional tennis player. And he's fallen into football. He's made a great career. He's been a superb player. he's decided to come back to Saint-Etienne. He hasn't quite worked out. He obviously has got problems in his private life. I think, you know, let him be in peace.
All right. Okay.
And that's it. And some of the comments I've read on the net are absolutely scandalous. And, you know, Twitterers, you know, shut up for a second.
Yeah, Twitterers.
No, some of the things I've been absolutely disgraceful.
Well, let's turn to a man who nobody tweets about. Johnny Legend, what's happened to Johan Gourcuff? Is he ever going to be as good as we all want him to be?
Well, first of all, he's got to be fit.
Right.
That's the first thing. Mm. Apparently, he's about to rejoin the group and so forth. Yes. That's the latest on Johan Gourcuff. The problem he has is that he's a player who is, how could I put it?
Talked about.
He's a player who doesn't fit the stereotype of the football player.
Right.
And he's somebody who is... I mean, finds it difficult to integrate in the sort of dressing room banter and so forth. His friends in football are few and far between. People like Hugo Lloris, for example, are quite close to him. Mm. Jérémy Toulalan as well. But Jérémy Toulalan has gone, of course, to Malaga. So he's got very few friends in the world of football. There are many people who are jealous of him because of the attention he received in the media, because of his looks, because he's, you know, very, very good looking chap, because of his behavior. He's somebody who doesn't speak a lot to his teammates, but his talent is extraordinary. And you know that Arsene Wenger tried to get him to the Arsenal, by the way, in this transfer window.
Well, there were some suggestions. And
no, it's not a suggestion, it's a fact.
Right,
he phoned Jean-Michel Aulas and he tried to get him on loan for a season. And I think maybe in a way that would have been the best thing for Johan Gourcuff. I think he needs to have some time away from the situation in you know that he's in at Lyon and generally in French football.
Right. Okay.
But he's a terrific talent. He's still very young, and you know,
when he's on, he's on. Woof.
Yep.
Okay. For Mika Atomica, what's Wenger's tone like when he commentates for France, especially regarding his former players? He commentates for who?
TF1.
And then that's how it's said, really.
I knew you would say that.
And how? And what's he like?
I don't think he's very good.
Oh.
He's quite guarded.
Because he doesn't see anything, probably. Hey?
No, he's very guarded in his comments. He's aware that he has, you know, he must be cautious about the comments he make. He has sometimes been known to let slip a few things, notably recently about Manchester United. By basically saying that they were not as good as they said they were and so forth. So sometimes the mask slips a little bit. But on the other hand, he's rather bland, I must say. And you would expect, for example, from a manager like him, a measure of tactical insight. I think you get far more from David Pleat or Graham Taylor than you get from Arsene Wenger. And I mean that seriously. I don't think, which also leads me to think that maybe Arsene Wenger doesn't care about tactics at all. Sometimes he will come up with a decent, I mean, he's good at analyzing the play and the players and how they're performing to evaluate their level of performance, but to make the public at large, but maybe it's due also to the fact it's a major channel as usual. The tone is rather lowbrow. I don't think he's given the space maybe to, that's the generous appreciation of him, but very bland. Oh, please.
No, I was saying, speaking of managers who like tactics, you've seen Rafa Benitez has started a blog.
Yeah, it's interesting, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a tactics blog. He's the new Michael Cox.
Lovely.
Yeah. He did a big thing on the Champions League final and slagging off Man United, basically.
Right.
Yeah, so maybe he'd be better than Wenger at all this.
Oh, I'm sure. He's a very personable man in the media, Rafa Benitez, don't you?
Yeah. No one seems to want him, though.
Well, he's got time on his hands and a steady income as well. So, that's good. Philippe, that's trivia. I'll just finish off with one or two more posts, one of which does relate. Alexandru Mercier says, Jimbo Woof, you mentioned my comment about the referee who awarded a penalty kick and then also booked the striker for faking the gravity of the injury. He said, yes, it happened in the Bordeaux-Saint-Etienne game on the first day of Ligue 1. And he posted a little link for it. Well done,
French refereeing, there's one thing I have to say, which an extraordinary thing which happened this season. I've never seen before. The hero of that is Abdoulaye Mete, this very subtle player, who whacked a player from behind and broke his ankle. Wait a minute. First of all, the referee arrives, gives him a yellow card, then has a look at the gravity of the injury, changes his mind, give him a red card. That's very unusual already.
Mm.
Then he goes to the disciplinary commission, Mr. Mater. He got 8 games, which would be impossible in the Premier League. I think, unless it was a really exceptional case. Because if you look at it at this foul on Mete on Kersia, it's bad. But I see worse challenges than that every weekend in the Premier League. So yellow card, then red card, then eight games, which is pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Mm. It is.
Didn't Ben Thatcher get retrospectively?
Yeah, but that was for an elbow.
In the face.
Yeah, that was different. Yeah. Mm.
All right, other anyway. Posts. Somebody asked, please discuss on the pod which footballer's released the best song ever. That's a terrific question. Next time we have an international break and a really short of stuff.
Well, I think that might be in relation to, as a video was turned up on YouTube of Paul McGrath singing Going Back by the Sandy Shaw number, and he's standing on a beach in Ireland, sort of gazing wistfully out to sea and skimming stones. And it's just quite odd, but... Right. Paul McGrath pretty much has license to do whatever he likes in Ireland, and if it makes him happy, good luck.
All right.
I think there's a Pulley track which we recorded with the Quartetto MC, which is one of the greatest MPB groups of all time. Quartetto MC.
Oh yeah, yeah, the quartet from the 70s, no?
60s and 70s.
Okay, and that was with Pele, was it?
Apparently, yes.
Oh, there you go. Thanks for that, whoever put that in. And Bala 77 contributed a list of options, but we'll move on. This being quite a long pod already. Nominative determinism update. Skink offers us, there's a gynecologist in California called Dr. Bonnie Beaver, and et cetera, and so on. Thanks for all your tweets on that. Just mentioned finally on nominative determinism. Rackles310 says, what's the opposite of nominative determinism? That award must go to Gentile, the Italian butcher. Art Deco says, how about Tim Lovejoy, who is to nominative determinism what Henry Kissinger is to the Nobel Peace Prize? Not very nice. Anyway, that's it for part two. I'm having a chuckle over that. Anyway, part three awaits around the kind of metaphorical corner, packed with Premier League goodness. This just in, Philippe Auclair has his tickets to see Toots and the Maytals at the Brixton Academy. All right. How old are they now, Philippe?
He's about 70.
Oh.
He looks about 50.
Right.
He's a genius.
But anyway, you got your tickets.
I got my tickets. I'm a much happier podder.
Yeah, whatever. Excellent. Ooh. All right. Well, think how delighted you're going to be after this terrific part three we have lined up, in which we discuss this week's fixtures in the Premier League. Man United on top of the table. They have Bolton away. It was 2-2 last year. It's a tough week, this, for United. Away to Bolton on Saturday, and then away to Benfica midweek in the Champions League. And, of course, Bolton now beefed up with N'Gog and Kakuta as well. And what?
Beefed up.
Yeah.
With N'Gog.
Yeah, and they kept Gary Cahill. Yeah, go on.
David Van Gogh.
Yeah. Right. N'Go. Yeah. I don't know. Every month it changes. Sometimes it's N'Go, and then they go, no, it's N'Gog. How do you pronounce it, Philippe?
N'Gog.
Okay, there you are.
Wow.
Lovely. Good. Man United, you're not concerned about them, are you?
Well, United have won 11 of their last 13 against Bolton.
Oh.
And people sort of, whenever we rattle off stats like that, people say, oh, well, what does it matter how they did against them 11 matches ago or 13? But it seems to make a difference.
Yeah, doesn't it? Man City have Wigan. How's their record against Wigan, then, eh?
They've won 4 of their last 5 to nil against Wigan.
Are we going to discuss a certain issue at Man City?
The email?
David Brent's email.
Right. I don't know. What would you like to say about it, Jacob?
I just really like Gary Cook. I hope he never leaves.
Right. Well, he does seem as though he's in some quite serious trouble now, despite the fact that it wasn't him.
No, it was a hacker.
It was a hacker. Who forwarded it.
Who just sent one email to Brian Marwood.
Right.
Copied in Mrs. Hanover.
It's an open and shut case, isn't it?
Yeah.
They find the hacker.
Ravaged with it. I don't know, he was just having some banter.
Right.
Harry,
ridiculous.
Anyway. He's in America at the moment, so it'll be sorted next week.
Yeah, he's in America, yeah.
Is he? Okay. Mm-hmm. They have Wigan anyway. Nasri will be playing despite his broken hand.
Well, they've put a plaster on his hand.
And well, normally, I mean, I say will be
playing. I mean, I remember Eric Cantona played almost a whole season with a fractured scaphoid.
Sammy Nasri's set to play.
Right. Yeah. If Mancini decides to go with him and not one of the other many talented.
Well, De Jong is back, which is.
Colo Torre is back from his ban in unrelated news. Barry?
Someone sent a very good letter into the Fiverr today inquiring which finger it was Nasri broke, the one he uses to count his money or the one he waved at Arsenal as he left the Emirates.
Hey, speaking of Arsenal, the season starts here. Gunners, just keep telling yourselves that. as you take on Swansea.
Thomas Vermaelen is out for 2 months.
Out for two
with
months.
An Achilles injury.
Mm. Jack Wilshere's out for a couple of months.
3 months. Yeah. In November, yeah.
Yeah, Theo Walcott's got a little hamstring injury.
He will play. He's all right. Yeah, he's all right, yeah.
Well, all right, then.
Yeah.
Is this the new dawn, then, Philippe?
New dawn of what?
Oh, I don't know. Of what? What is it a new dawn of?
You could say the season starts. I don't quite agree with that because the season could have ended already.
Yeah.
Udinese was a huge result to go through. There are loads of jokes on the net at the moment, people saying, you've invited me for the 11th of October. I'm terribly sorry. I'll be attending the Arsenal end of season do that day, which is not very kind. But... Well, I'll be going to the Emirates. I'm really
nil-nil, I reckon.
Not against Swansea, I don't think so.
No?
No.
Terrific keeper.
Swansea haven't scored yet.
That's the nil side for them.
They play such an open game that, you know, it's a bit like... I remember a game against Reading Arsenal played when Arsenal were not very well, and then suddenly Reading came along and they beat them 4-0 or something and things started to look a bit better.
Well, my reasoning is quite simple. They held Man City goalless for about an hour until they brought on Sergio Aguero, more or less. I think I might be fudging that one slightly. And Arsenal don't have Sergio Aguero to bring on. So
they've got Theo Walcott.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
Anyway, well, there you go. But you're optimistic that this could be the first tiny step towards recovery.
I'm not overly optimistic, no. I must say. I'm still very much waiting to see how things pan out. At the moment, it's as if somebody has thrown out all these ingredients in the air, waiting for them to fall in the right pan.
Mm.
Strange metaphor, but there you go.
Mm-hmm. Very French metaphor.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And I really don't know. I mean, the body language of Arsene Wenger indicates that he's somebody who is pricklier and bristlier and more paranoid than he's ever been.
Mm.
It could be, he has no one to turn to, as we all know. The attitude of the board is very strange. Not a squeak comes out of that. They've done, I think, rather well out of the summer market, considering how badly they managed it.
Mm.
Because every single of their target fell by the wayside, or they held on too long. They played a game of patience with people like Mata and Cazorla when they could have had them. They waited too long. They went elsewhere. And all things being considered, you think Mertesacker, Andres Santos, I'm quite interested to see that because defensively he's not the soundest or safest of left-backs, is he?
Mm. Apparently not. Meantime, Everton, well, the full grimness of their reality is presumably about to set in as they take on Aston Villa. Arteta's gone too. Arsenal, Victor Anachibi's out till Christmas. They only had three strikers now, and Anachibi's one of them. He's got injured with Nigeria midweek. That leaves Louis Sahar, who's already injured, I think.
Is he already injured?
Yeah. I think that's
he's always injured.
Always injured. And this fellow, Strakulursi, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, the Argentine, who was top scorer in Argentina, much as Mauro Boselli was in a previous season. So it's, interesting times ahead.
But they can just put Tim Cahill up front.
That is true.
Yeah.
Is he injured?
Cahill, who hasn't scored this year, I think.
But I think he's been injured.
He scored for Australia.
There's a group of Everton fans, I can't remember what they call themselves, but they've been very busy canvassing journalists and various news agencies and whatnot. They're taking a leaf out of Liverpool's book and having a protest march from a pub they were going to be in to a match they were going to anyway. It worked at Liverpool, and just they're very concerned about the stagnation of the club. So
But who are they protesting against? Bill Kenwright?
They want Bill Kenwright to sell up.
Well, so does Bill Kenwright.
It's a bit like demonstrating against rain or thunder or something like that.
Yeah.
Bill Kenwright, I mean, see, what is extraordinary is that in many other countries, Bill Kenwright would be seen as a paragon among chairmen, somebody who has who deeply cares for his club, doesn't quite have the money to run it as he would like to run it, has maintained his faith in David Moyes when Everton nearly relegated. And many people would look at that and say, well, it's just a bad patch, guys. Stick together instead of asking for a guy who is loyal and faithful to your club to go.
Yeah, nice bit of perspective.
I can't believe that David Moyes is still there, to be honest, sort of the way that it is. And I would have thought he might fancy a different challenge because there's nowhere else for him to, nothing else for him to do at Everton, is there? And, I think maybe he could go abroad, manage abroad if there's no jobs in the top four or the top six going.
Mm.
He's not going to win the league with Everton or get into Europe now.
But the thing is, these fans were already very unhappy before the transfer window shut, and now Arteta, Ikubu, and Beckford are all gone. So the club is in a worse state.
Well, they had debt they had payments to make Everton. They had no choice. Mm. Do the fans want the club to go bankrupt for good? Is that what they want? You know, if there's no buyer there, and if you have a club which is in a very, very bad financial situation, of course you're not going to find a buyer. Or you're going to find somebody who wants to do a funny job with the club, as has happened elsewhere.
Well, so, West Ham got David Sullivan and David Gott. I mean, I know that, you know, they're amusing and everything.
Yeah, but there's
they
have an Olympic stadium at the end of it, you know. There's nice piece of prime estate in the East End to sell and an Olympic stadium to move into. Mm. Everton. I mean, everything depends on the stadium question. By the way, what's the news on that?
Well, I think it's gone away completely, no?
There is no news.
Mm. There is no news.
Yeah.
Mm. Very grim. Very unfortunate. Sunderland-Chelsea. Hey, Chelsea won this 4-2 last year, but that was before Nicholas Bentner turned up at the Stadium of Light. Behold the Bentner, Chelsea. Be afraid. Two goals for Denmark this week.
I think he could be good. I'm absolutely pleased he's gone to Sunderland, particularly when Georges Samaras was being linked with Sunderland shortly before they signed Bentner. I was thinking, if Georges Samaras is the answer, what on earth is the question? Because he's awful. Can't hack it in the SPL. I really hope Bentner does well, and I think he might.
You're a Sunderland fan, of course you hope he does well.
Well, yes. I've always maintained that there is somewhere in there a good player sort of bursting.
He's a good player. He's actually got a very good goals-to-game ratio. It's not good enough for Arsenal.
All right.
I would beg to disagree. I mean, if you asked any Arsenal fan, who would you like to go, Chamakh or Bentner? Everyone would say Chamakh, please. Well, yeah, now, keep Bentner because he's a man.
Oh, go in the sense of
leave as far as you can. And I must say it's a little bit strange. I think the reasons why he's left Arsenal have more to do with relationships maybe within the club than with his talent. I think he's not a top class player, but he's a very useful player.
He's just a funny squad. He's a funny player because he's got such a big opinion of himself, and he's not as good as he thinks he is.
There's a great story about
Bentner. As everyone thinks he is.
Arsenal make their players go through a psychological tests, which are done by a friend of mine, and called Jacques Crevoisier. It's not a secret. And he once told me we have a test about self confidence, and when we did Bentner, he got 10 out of 9.
who had the worst adventure?
That would be breaching the secret.
Right, okay.
This is more of a joke.
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay.
All right then. Trouble ahead for big sides department. I've got here Stoke, Liverpool, and Wolves, Spurs. I can see both of those going the wrong way.
It's an interesting game for Stoke and Liverpool. Both are unbeaten. Stoke are playing really well at the moment, but as are Liverpool.
Crouchy, Palacios.
Yeah, Crouch against his old club as well.
Yeah.
I think probably a draw in that one.
Do you think?
Yeah.
All right.
And Spurs having big problems at Molineux. I think everybody can see that coming.
Champions League contenders Wolves.
Yep.
Against relegation battlers Spurs.
Yep.
Certain relish
in
your voice.
Getting my digs in there.
As you say.
No, but I think it's also because we all agreed that of the teams that were in danger of being relegated last year, Wolves were probably the best, producing superb games against the top sides in particular. And the state that Tottenham is in at the moment.
Van der Vaart out for six weeks, is it?
Yeah, we don't see when you see Younes Kabul the way he was defending, if that's the word, against Manchester City. You think, oh, God. He was defending with the French team as well. Heavens above.
This game finished 3-3 last season. It was absolutely brilliant. So hopefully it'll be like that again.
All right, then.
Mm-hmm.
What are you covering this weekend?
I don't know yet. On Sunday.
All right, then. All right.
Maybe the tennis.
New Zealand, Tonga, I am.
New Zealand, Tonga?
Yeah.
You're on the rugby.
What's that?
It's rugby.
All right. Also, on your Premier League dance card are Norwich and West Brom and QPR, Newcastle.
And Fulham v Blackburn.
And how did I possibly miss that? Fulham-Blackburn. Hey, speaking of which, what was the problem at Craven Cottage before the Brazil-Ghana game?
Yeah, my friend Benji Lanyada, who works for The Guardian, was there, and he said that he was outside the ground just before it was... just before kickoff, and was basically in a massive crush, lifted off his feet. There was not enough staff, not enough security guards.
Because the club have denied that there was a big problem.
Yeah, and apparently the police said, well, you should have turned up earlier. And, you know, they apparently had a couple of porter cabins with people handing out tickets. They didn't expect that many people to turn up for it, basically.
It was only Brazil playing, it's true.
And Ghana,
there are no Ghanaians in London, as we know.
Paul Doyle wrote about it, and the club spoke to someone at Fulham, and they seemed disturbingly dismissive of what seemed to be a quite serious problem. They maintain that it wasn't as bad as Benji claimed. And they said the problem was that the supporters were too busy sort of having fun outside and wouldn't go into the ground.
Because they hadn't got their tickets, mostly. A lot of people were posting that they were stuck basically in this heaving mass trying to get the tickets, and at one point the staff just gave out and started handing envelopes of tickets out into the crowd to sort out themselves.
Craven Cottage, it's a very small area, yeah. You know, it's, the streets are small, and I've been outside the ground there I've been late into the ground because it's so difficult to get in. So it's not the safest place if there's loads and loads of people.
Wow. All right. Well, that pretty much wraps it up for today, but not before we answer those questions, eh, Jacob?
Yeah, what were the questions?
Well, you got them there, haven't you? All right.
First player to miss a penalty
in the FA Cup. You got them there,
yeah. First player to miss a penalty in the FA Cup final was Charlie Wallace in 1913, Aston Villa v Sunderland.
Right.
Yeah.
But surely Sky weren't transmitting in those days, Jacob. what was the other one?
The other one was Tony Adams was the last England player. England v Ukraine before Euro 2000.
Right. Yeah. Were there any two questions we asked?
And we also asked the one
Thierry Henry one.
Yeah, the Thierry Henry.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
I can give them a bonus one if they
want. Here's a bonus one. This is from the round that Jacob and his cohorts failed to get a single right answer from, right?
Is it?
These are the opening lines of footballers' autobiographies. See if you can identify this footballer. And if you like this kind of thing, then go to the Opta Sports website.
Yeah, go to Opta's website or their Twitter, Opta Suit.
And by Friday, they'll have all the answers up anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Sometimes I think that my whole life is on film, that my whole life is in print, but it's not like that. It's not like that at all. There are things which are only in my heart that no one knows.
Robbie Savage.
Ian Dowie.
Ian Dowie. Well, no, you answered David Beckham, didn't you?
We answered David Beckham.
But you answered wrong.
We did answer wrong.
The correct answer is?
They can find out tomorrow.
All right, then. Have that, listeners. Magnificent. Thanks ever so much, Filippo Clare. And to you too, Jacob Steinberg and Barry Glendinning. A terrific pod. I enjoyed it, certainly. Producer Ben, many thanks to you and you, listeners. We'll be back on Monday. I'll be back with a little paper review on Friday. But anyway, until we next speak, have a terrific time.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.